The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26...
The sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald is one of the most famous shipwreck stories in Great Lakes history, and probably a part of it was we can lay on Gordon Lightfoot with his wonderful song. And you're probably going to have that music running through your head the rest of the day here, Larry Mueller here. It you know that the sinking, while very well known, it's also in some ways one of maritime's greatest mysteries. And our guest is the author of a new book on this shipwreck, Michael Schumacher. He's written four previous books on Great Lakes shipwrecks, Mighty Fitz, November's Fury, Torn in Two, and The Wreck of the Carl D. And he's also written narratives for 25 Great Lakes shipwreck and lighthouse documentary films. His new book is called The Trial of the Edmund Fitzgerald, Eyewitness Accounts from the U.S. Coast Guard Hearings. So talking with him about was and wasn't determined in that trial. And I hope you'll join in. What are your thoughts on this famous shipwreck or maybe experience relating to it? Why do you think the public is still so interested? Join in the conversation. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Michael Schumacher, welcome back. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I really enjoy these conversations.
Yeah, we've had many a talk, and it's always been fun. You've written about the Fitzgerald before. Why another book?
And you know, it's funny because I've explained this to friends, everybody from friends to readers. It's like the accidental book. It wasn't something that I did a lot of time thinking about. It was about a year and a half ago, I guess. I was going through papers, filing things, from other books and so forth. And I came across a great big box, like the ones they give you in the grocery stores or whatever, they put bananas in, those great big banana boxes. And all it said on the box was Fitz. And I'm looking at this, I thought I had filed my Fitzgerald stuff already. So I opened it up, and what it was all of the testimony from the Coast Guard hearings. And every witness had his own special clip, and I just picked one of them up and started reading it just for kicks. I had no reason to do it. And it was Bernie Coopers, who was the master of the ship right behind the Fitzgerald in the storm. And I was in contact with the Fitzgerald till literally minutes before she disappeared. And I started reading and going, boy, this is good stuff. I'd forgotten how good this testimony was. And then I was thinking, it's a shame that nobody will ever see this. I had flown out to Washington, D.C. I'd photocopied the entire Fitzgerald vault. And therein hangs another tale. But the entire vault, I sat at a photocopying machine for two solid days, from the minute they opened till the minute they closed, copying all this testimony and such. And I'm thinking, I'm probably one of, I don't know what, maybe 10 people who will ever see this.
Yeah.
And I thought, boy, that's a shame to know that this good stuff by the people, in many cases, or most cases probably, who either worked on the Fitzgerald who were out in that storm that night, either, behind the Fitzgerald in the case of the Arthur Anderson, or looking for the Fitzgerald after it was reported that she was missing. And this was just absolutely riveting stuff. But I didn't do anything with it. I read Bernie's, testimony and put the lid back on the box and was going to file it. And I don't know what it was, maybe a month later or so, I was having a conversation about another project with my publisher. And we were just talking, he said, what else is that, type deal. And I said, what happened? The weirdest thing happened to me. And I told him what I just told you. And there's this pause on the phone, and he goes, well, we'd like that. thinking, oh, God, Schumacher, you really got yourself into it this time. So what we did on this was there were several things that weren't in Mighty Fitz. All of his testimony, of course. There was a little snippet here, you know, a line or a line there. But to have it in this detail, you know, wasn't there. And then second, I didn't include any of the reports, the Coast Guard, the Safety Board report, the Lake Carriers Association report. Most of the books on the Fitzgerald include those. I did not. And then last, and this is significant to a lot of people, and it was intentionally done so by me with the book, was there were no pictures.
Yeah.
With Mighty Fitz, there are no pictures. There's a painting on a front cover, on a back cover, and on the frontispiece. And that's it. You get the Fitzgerald in its glory days, you see it in its wreckage, and you see it in the storm, you know, in paintings. But that's it. So I had these things to go with, and it turned out that it was a lot bigger book in terms of size than Mighty Fitz, you know, because there's a lot of material to go through there. And so
and a lot of great photos, too.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much stuff there that wasn't so. I figure now I've pretty much done it. I've had, because the temptation here is to call this a companion book, but it's also a standalone book in the respect that the story of the Fitzgerald, you know, from the minute they loaded it, the day it went out for its last journey, to the finding of the boat when they actually found the wreckage, is told. That whole story is told, but it's in the voices of the people that were involved, as opposed to Mighty Fitz, which I wrote up and it included their voices, but I wrote the book. And so it does stand alone. You get the whole Fitzgerald story, you get the reports, you get the photos. So it's also a book for people who don't have Mighty Fitz. They could pick this book up and enjoy the story, if you enjoy such a story. Because that night, anybody that was connected to that night will always have memories. I remember talking to Fred Stonehouse, who's a wonderful maritime writer. He's written all sorts of books, including about the Fitzgerald. And I was talking to Fred about it. He lives in Marquette, Michigan, and the water in a storm was so incredible. He went out and took movies. Uh-huh. You know, you couldn't believe. We had one of those, incidentally, down here just a little over a week ago, where people were literally driving their car to the scene, to Lake Michigan, the shoreline, and taking movies of the waves, because I had never seen anything like this before. Those waves were like 15 feet tall at the shoreline.
Yeah.
And that, I don't even want to imagine what it was like in the middle of the lake, because they're usually breaking up by the time they get to the shoreline. And so Fred had done that. Then I talked to other people that were out in the waters that night. And everybody has a story, because it was so immense. The idea of losing a vessel the size of the Edmund Fitzgerald was unheard of.
Yeah.
You know, it had been out in bad storms before, including the one that took the Carl D. Bradley. It was out that night. And, you know, so there's all of this that comes at you, and you realize there's a whole book here yet that I haven't been involved in. So, of course, I told my editor, well, let me look into it, and I gave him my thoughts on it, and we decided to go ahead with it. That such is history.
You know, that it's really compelling reading to me, especially when you know, through the words of the people who were involved the night of the storm. And as I looked through this, I thought, God, he had thousands of pages. How did you decide even what to pull from here?
You know, it really wasn't easy in some cases, because a perfect example is what you just said. The storm itself, these guys all had incredible descriptions of it. Yeah. And there's only so much room, you know, that you could devote to that before you have to move on. And so I did cut some material that was pretty good, you know, but I cut it in favor of material that was even better. And I tried to get every voice. I believe it was like 68, if I remember right, was the number of people they interviewed. And it was very fresh, incidentally, in the minds of the people who were interviewed.
You're right.
You know, before the board. the first the Fitz sank on a Monday, and on Thursday they were having their first witness. So, you know, this was a storm they not only had sailed through or sailed into if they were looking for the Fitzgerald. It was very fresh on their minds. And so the way that they told the stories was so amazing. You know, I mean, I can only imagine what it would have been to be one of those four board members listening to this. And I interviewed two of them for Mighty Fitz. The only thing that I thought was missing for this book, and I was really sorry that it had happened, was Erickson, the captain of the William Clay Ford that had gone out to look for it. He's no longer alive, and nor was he asked to testify, and I thought that was too bad. And then there was a guy named Jimmy Holbaugh who came from Michigan, or not, I'm sorry, from Minnesota. He came in from Minnesota to help look for the Fitz, but he was there. He was out in the storm. He also was there looking for the Fitz when they found, because of a sonar side scan, they found the ship. And then he was in the head of the boat that was the anchor boat, so to speak, when they went.
You know what? We're going to keep you here, Michael. We need to take a quick look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet. So hold that thought. We'll be back with our guest today, Michael Schumacher, right after the news. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at a new book about the Edmund Fitzgerald shipwreck on the show today. Larry Mueller here with my guest by phone, Michael Schumacher. He's written four books on Great Lakes shipwrecks, and he's just added a fifth, The Trial of the Edmund Fitzgerald, Eyewitness Accounts from the U.S. Coast Guard Hearings. So, do you remember the wreck and the hearing that followed? What were your thoughts then and now? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And as I was saying, Michael, as you were talking about, it was, I know it had to be tough to get everybody in, and there were some wish you'd have been able to get that you weren't able to get, but that's, you know, there's anytime you're writing a book, there comes a point where you got to take the best stuff you got and go from there.
That's it. You really have to know when to say stop or no or something at some point where you know you have the best thing that can happen, in fact, is that you have too much information. I've always thought that. The more, the better. And then you have to make certain decisions, you know, on how you're going to do this. And it isn't always easy. You know, I know this with some of the other books that I've edited, you know, rather than written, that, you know, it's almost painful to say no to this or that or whatever, you know, statements are concerned, because you have other ones that are stated better or whatever. But that doesn't mean there's less to it. You know, I'm sure that we have not heard the last of the Edmund Fitzgerald, because it's such a popular shipwreck that there'll be others in the future. Incidentally, before I go any further, it was kind of funny. Gordon Lightfoot and I both got really interested in the Edmund Fitzgerald after reading a single article that was in Newsweek magazine. He was coming home from a tour in Europe, and he was on the plane, you know, and he just picks up a Newsweek, and he ran across this, and he's a very, very interested person in terms of anything nautical. And so when he read this, he's like, wow. And that's what happened to me. Even though the Edmund Fitzgerald's home port was Milwaukee, so there was a lot of reportage around this section of, you know, the country, it was still, that article just kind of brought it all together. And it was kind of funny, you know, that coincidence that both of us really
Yeah.
Really became involved because of the same article.
Interesting. You know, Ken in Wanakee has something for us. Let's go there.
Sure.
Hi, Ken.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
I used to be a machinist in the machine shop in the chemistry building at the University of Wisconsin, and I work with a grad student by the name of David Coleman. And after the Edmund Fitzgerald went down, he was worried about his father, who was the cook on the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Oh.
But his father happened to get the flu, and
yes,
he had to get a substitute cook to go out on the ship.
You know, that was one of the most moving stories that I heard in the entire process of both of these books combined, was I talked to the daughter of the cook who did die, who was the substitute, and she told me this story. It just raised the hairs on the back of my neck, so to speak, of she went, she lives in Kansas, which is not a Great Lakes state, obviously, and she went to her first. She never went to those memorials that they hold every year in Whitefish Point, you know, but she went to one. It was, I think, and I could be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure it was the 25th or 30th anniversary of the loss of the boat. And she went up there and she told me this story. She said, on the night of the Fitzgerald sinking, I went out to the water. She said, and I was wearing a dress. And I had to do something. So I waded into that water. And anybody that's ever walked into Lake Superior knows what cold is. And she said, I was up to, you know, right about my knees in the water. She said, I wanted to know what my dad was feeling when that boat went down.
Yeah.
And she said she had, from the hotel she was staying, she had an empty shampoo bottle. And she took that empty bottle and she filled it with water from Lake Superior. And she still has it to this day, incidentally. She says, my dad's DNA is in this water.
Boy.
And I thought that was so moving, you know, just to hear her tell the whole story about going down there. And, you know, it wasn't stormy or anything, but she wanted to just experience something because that was quite a loss to her. She told me all about her and her dad, and that's in Mighty Fitz, that story. You know, where sometimes it's hard to imagine until you talk to the people who face this unbearable loss, you know, and so hearing that from her was valuable to me. And that's how it was with this testimony that I included in this book. These people told the story from an individual's standpoint. I was in my bunk doing this and that, and they came in, they told me, you know, whatever it was, you know, or what it was like to be out on the water that night. You know, to have the captain and the well-seasoned one at that, of the Arthur Anderson right behind. It was about 10 miles, I think, when the Fitz went down. It started out about 15, and the Fitzgerald cut its speed because it knew it was in trouble and wanted to make sure that they had a boat nearby. And his description of everything, the storm, from his own, what he saw with his own eyes. You know, he said, we got hit by a couple of waves, one of them that covered the hatch crane on the deck. A hatch crane is about 15 feet. So they had 15 feet of water going over their deck. That's a whole lot of water. And, you know, then you hear those stories like the one this gentleman just mentioned of somebody who was supposed to have been there and was sick, and so they got somebody else, and that person perished. You know, they're really something to hear these stories from these people.
Rick emailed that on the morning that the loss of the Fitzgerald was reported, Rick was employed on the estate of Francis Ferguson, CEO of Northwestern Mutual Life, owners of the Fitzgerald. Mr. Ferguson and his wife, Patty, were at their ranch in Arizona, and it fell on Rick to inform them of the tragedy. Mr. Ferguson told him to meet the plane at Mitchell Field at 5 p.m. He said we were going to have a long night.
Yes. I always wondered about that. And I've heard little bits and pieces about Edmund Fitzgerald himself, for whom they named the boat. You know, what a horrible thing to have to live with is that your namesake, so to speak, went down and took 29 people with it. You know, and it was something that he could not quite come to grips with, because you don't come to grips with something like that. This is something that nature had a say in, and it just so happened that the boat, the same thing with the Carl Bradley, although if I recall correctly, Carl Bradley was gone, you know, when that boat went down. The thing that was amazing about the Fitz was it was a pretty new boat. They used to build those boats back in the day to last 75 years or so, you know, and the Fitz was, it was about 20 years old. It wasn't that old. Yeah. And it was big, big, powerful boat. And everyone I talked to told me that everybody dreamed of working on that boat.
Yeah. Kate in Ashland has something for us. Kate, let's mm-hmm. go to you.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for calling, Kate. You've got a story for us.
I do. My dad was a second cook on the Edmund Fitzgerald, and he went down with the ship.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting to me that you would have talked with the daughter of the person who must have been the head cook that
yes.
he was working with when
yes.
that happened. And then to hear you also mention the Anderson, because I had gone to school that day.
Uh-huh.
One of my classmates' father was on the Anderson.
Ah, yeah.
We were trying, you know, because they're like, oh, it'll be okay. Well, obviously it wasn't. But
right.
it was definitely, and still is, you know, a big, what do you want to say? Obviously, it's a huge event in my life and many
sure.
other people. And it's interesting to me how many people's lives, as you, you know, as you go out and out and out from the center, how many
right.
people's lives have been affected. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it is. And you can't figure how that happens, you know,
I know.
To those people.
Yeah.
Kate,
I'm sorry.
It's okay. My father was not supposed to be on there that year either. He
right.
had been on there, and he was supposed to be on a different ship, but they needed somebody out. They needed
right.
another cook on there. And so he went out. He loved being on the boats. He loved
yep.
what he was doing. And, you know, you have to try to put it all in perspective. And
right.
I guess if somebody is doing what they love, there's risks, but
right.
he was willing to.
And they don't
that.
Think of those risks. It's real funny because I've talked to, I mean, literally a couple hundred people that have worked on these boats, and their take is essentially the same. If you don't feel safe on this boat, you can't feel safe anywhere.
Yeah.
Because you don't get up in the morning, you get in your car to go to the local store to pick up some milk and think, I could be killed on the way here. You
yeah.
know, you don't think of it. Yeah, and that's what these people have told me about working on those boats. It's not something. There is an occasion. There was one guy that worked on the Carl Bradley. He ran the boom, the big self-unloading boom, and he was petrified of dying in a storm. He was, every time there was a storm, he'd be up near the top, you know, of the boat, near the deck, the spar deck, and he would just watch. And he told his son, who worked with him for 1 year, he said, if anything happens, meet me here. He was terrified of dying, and guess what? He went down with the Carl Bradley.
Oh.
You know, it's one of those things when you talk to people about it, for the most part, they don't even consider that the boat could sink. They don't
yeah.
consider it.
Yeah.
And I remember being out one time in Detroit, and I was at the Dawson Museum, which is a wonderful ship museum, maritime museum, right off the coast of Detroit, of Michigan, right by Detroit. And I did a little talk, and everything was fine. And then it was time to go home. And my host said to me, what are you going to do now? I said, what do you mean now? I mean, immediately? He said, yeah. What are you doing this afternoon? It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon or something. And I said, nothing. I'll probably just go back to the hotel. He says, you want to go deliver some mail? And I said, what do you mean? He said, come with me. And we went down right by the water, the Detroit River. And there was it was bigger than a shack, but it was, you know, a fairly small building. Inside, there was nothing but cubbyholes with mail for the people on these boats. And he said, I got two ships I got to take the, you know, mail to. He said, slip on a life jacket and we'll go out there. And, you know, I'm giving you the short version of it, because he told me about why I had to wear a life jacket and it gave me the fear of God, because that very boat we were going out with had been at the bottom of the lake only months earlier. It got caught up in the wake of one of those big ships and it flipped. But anyway, we get out there. You know, you go out and all of a sudden here's this massive boat sitting there, and we pull right up, and there were tires mounted, you know, to the sides of the boat, and it slammed right up against the side of the boat. And down came, because this is the technology age, right, a pickle bucket on a rope. And he clipped the mail to this pickle bucket, and up it went. And while he was doing it, I was sitting there. I was on the side that was slammed up against the boat. I'd leaned out, and I was running my hand over, you know, the hull of the boat. And it had seen some action. It had hit the sides of, say, the Sioux Locks or something. There were little marks on it and this and that. And obviously, to my host, who had driven us out there, I was impressed, you know, because he looked at me then afterwards. We were pulling away. It was time to go. It was one of those glorious fall afternoons. I remember that because a lot of the crew was up on the deck. They were making hot dogs on little grills and stuff, you know, hot dogs and hamburgers. And we were shouting back and forth. And I was just having a good old time. And he looked at me and says, now imagine that boat sinking.
Yeah.
And I said, I can't. Are you kidding me? Look at this thing. How can you possibly imagine it sinking? And that goes back to what, you know, Kate was saying earlier. You know, and then how I responded was the idea that people you know work on these boats, you know, especially in maritime communities such as Rogers City, Michigan, that lost so many people. On the Carl Bradley, you know these people. They're not going to die. They're not going to go out there and die. Well, hell, Kobe Bryant isn't going to go out there and die.
Right.
You know, but it does happen.
It does. It does happen. And I tell you what, Michael, you have done a great job here in your book and putting together the book. We haven't talked as much about it as I wish we had time to do, but I really appreciate all the work you put into putting this together. You know, you were talking about the size, and I'm thinking one of the photos in your book really takes it home to me, and that's the size of the propeller of the Edmund Fitzgerald that was pulled up. It's one of the kind of interesting things that you will see when you take a look at Michael's book, The Trial of the Edmund Fitzgerald. My goodness, it's a wonderful story, and I'm really glad he's had a chance to tell it because it's a story that needed to be told and retold. There's a lot in this book. And Michael, again, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really, really appreciate it very, very much. I'm going to take another look at something else today. Winter's a great time to visit the theater, whole different topic, and let yourself be carried away. And we have a particularly enchanting show full of magic and imagination coming up to talk about.
We are always on the lookout for new and different entertainment, so a performance scheduled on February 13 at the Young Auditorium in Whitewater caught our eye. It's called Yow Yow. It's billed as a playful blend of reality and imagination using interactive screen art technology and live music. We have Aaron Wesolowski with us. He's the marketing specialist for the Young Auditorium, and we're going to find out more about it. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for telling us about Yow Yow. We should probably start by having you spell that.
Sure. Yow Yow is spelled Y-A-O-Y-A-O.
Okay. And that's a Korean, correct?
Yes, South Korean.
Yeah. And what is the show all about?
Sure. Yow Yow is a show kind of for families and kids of all ages. It's a really creative show that deals with a young girl and her father. She hates when he leaves for work every day. And one day she pulls on the thread to his coat as he leaves, and it starts this kind of crazy, magical, creative journey that involves live music, two really amazing actors, and what they call magical screen art. So they use a screen along with physical props and a little bit of kind of theater magic to help create a really engaging, wonderful family show.
Well, I've seen some pictures and a couple of little snippets of video, and it really does look enchanting, if that's a good word for it.
Yeah, absolutely. From the moment that we entered the theater for Yao Yao, we could tell that we were in for a really great experience. And one of the things that really kind of put it over the edge for us in terms of wanting to bring Yao Yao here to Whitewater is the fact that there's something in it for all ages.
Mm-hmm.
If you bring a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old to this show, they're going to be able to appreciate the lights and the sound and kind of the physicality of what's going on stage. Older kids are probably going to be a little bit more in tune with the message and the music, and adults. So often, you know, as an adult, you'll go to a children's performance, and it's for your kids. There's not much
sure.
there for you.
Mm-hmm.
But the emotional level and the emotional chord that this show hits, I think, is going to be really special for parents and families to come to together.
Well, that really, it does sound like a fun time. Why don't you tell us just a tiny little bit about the Young Auditorium? Now, you're part of the University of Whitewater, and you guys have great stuff all the time. What's kind of like the mission of the organization?
Sure. Yeah, Young Auditorium is here. We're on the UW-Whitewater's campus. As a 1,300-seat professional theater venue, you know, we do serve the university, but moreover, like you said, we book a full season of world-class professional entertainment every season. So every school year, we've got about 25 performances that we put on. Now, some of the highlights for the spring performances here at Young Auditorium is the nationally touring Broadway show Finding Neverland. That's the story of J.N. Barrie, the author of Peter Pan. So we're really excited about that one coming up. Our other Broadway title is An American in Paris, obviously based on the Academy Award-winning film. We're really excited to have this nationally touring Broadway show.
That's going to be some wonderful dancing, I'm sure.
Absolutely. If you've seen the movie, you'll know that there's plenty of wonderful dancing that you'll see in An American in Paris.
Definitely. Why don't you tell people where they can go to get tickets?
Sure, absolutely. The easiest place to get tickets and information is at our website, youngauditorium.com. Otherwise, you can call our Young Auditorium offices at 262-472-4444.
Wonderful. Thank you, Aaron, so much. We really appreciate you telling us about all the events there.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome. If you have an event you'd like to tell us about, email timeoutwisconsin@wpr.org and find a link to the event we talked about today at wpr.org/timeout. I'm Jill Nadeau. Until next month, get out and explore, dream, and discover.
Yo-yo.
Sounds like a magical adventure to me. What about you?
And as Jill said, if you have an event you'd like to suggest for our Time Out Wisconsin segment, please give us a shout. Go to timeoutwisconsin@wpr.org, and we'll have more for you next month. Until then, I hope you enjoy taking time to get out and explore Wisconsin. And just a note, tomorrow on Garden Talk, Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston, stops by to talk about a couple of new types of blight. Oh, goody. Stay with us. Lots in store.